This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, upcoming events at the North Dakota Museum of Art. But first, high school is supposed to prepare you for your next step. And for decades, students were pushed into pursuing four-year liberal arts degrees, leaving some workforce gaps in the hands-on careers. Today, there's a resurgence in teaching tech ed, and it's going to new heights in our state's capital. The Bismarck Public School District recently purchased an airplane to help aviation students get their private pilot's licenses. Dale Haroth is Director of Career and Technical Education for Bismarck Public Schools, and he recently gave me a tour of the Bismarck Career Academy and Tech Center. What draws you to career and technical education?
Well, I think what draws me to it is seeing students engaged. I mean, you know, there's a whole class of students that, you know, instead of just sitting in rows and desks, to be able to do something with their hands and knowing that they're good at that and being able to show somebody and actually get a job in it. I mean, it's living a dream being able to walk around here and seeing students being able to do that.
Well, I'm walking around here and I honestly thought that this was college level.
And it's good. What we do is we have a partnership with Bismarck State College. And so with our partnership with higher ed, you know, everybody talks about students needing going from secondary to post-secondary. Well, we live that. The students are really here. And so even though it's a public school building, this is Bismarck Public Schools, we're on the campus and students can go from these classes right into post-secondary if that's what they want to do. And so it's a really good fit.
What programs do you offer here?
We offer multiple programs. We offer electronics. We offer aviation. We offer agriculture, mid-careers, graphic arts, auto tech, auto collision, welding, engineering, architecture, and, you know, carpentry. So.
And for high school students?
They are for high school students, that's right.
Is there any kind of tuition associated with classes here?
No, there's none. It's all free. And so it's just like anything else. I mean, if you're going to take an English class, I mean, you don't pay for it to take an English class when you're in high school. Same way here, those are free. The only cost might be is if you are going to get your private pilot's license or if you're going to, you know, build something like a shed and have to, you know, want to take a shed home. That would be the only thing that there would be a cost to.
So the funding for this, is this part of normal high school education funding where it would be property taxes or maybe something from the state? Or did there have to be something special? Because, yeah, like you said, you don't pay to go to an English class, but an English class does not come with a computer program designed to teach you how to fly an airplane.
No, this is funded by the Bismarck Public Schools, but we also have a federal Carl Perkins grant. And a Carl Perkins grant allows us to buy equipment. And that is in any career and technical education program, if you're meeting the standards and you have the qualified instructors. So we get a grant for the equipment. But other than that, I mean, virtually everything is funded by Bismarck Public Schools, just like you would fund a regular high school.
Why did the Career Academy decide to get its own plane?
Well, we have so many students that want to fly, and so sometimes it's difficult getting an airplane out at the airport, and they've been good to us, but, you know, that gets to be a difficulty, and so this way we have one at our own beck and call, so to speak. The other thing I would say is that when we teach an auto tech program, we need hoist in order for those auto tech students. Here we need a plane for aviation, and so it's the convenience of being able to have our students get the plane at any time they want it. The other thing that you cannot do with rented planes is they won't allow you to fill it with fuel and check air pressure and check oil and do some of the maintenance because, you know, they just don't want that. This is huge for our students to be able to do that. So not only do you know how to fly a plane, but you're learning how to take care of it. And the learning happens when you're able to take care of something because now you want to know why that's important or why you can't go up in that kind of weather if that's it. So I think that's really one of the biggest things why we have our own purchasing our own plane.
Where did the funding come from for a plane?
The funding came from Robert Watts. Robert Watts was the father of aviation, I would say, in Bismarck, North Dakota. And he gave the Bismarck Public Schools Foundation $1 million towards an aviation program because when he passed away, he thought it was a wonderful program. He wanted students to learn how to fly. And so because of him, we are able to have some funding that would help students with flying. And this is one of them, and to get an airport plane, because normally you couldn't probably do that.
What's the job market potential for people with private pilot's license? I grew up in a very rural town, and obviously, you know, decades ago, and it seemed like there were a few kids who had private licenses, and they were crop dusters. I assume there's a lot more potential out there now.
Right. That you can do that, but right now it's about commercial pilots and pilots in airplanes. The number of pilots that are needed right now, everybody's starting to retire. And all the airplanes, in fact, I don't know if you know this, but many of the planes have to go down and sit on runways because they don't have the pilots available. I mean, you know, the major airlines do not have pilots. And so there's just a demand. And so students, this is a golden opportunity for them, and especially with the University of North Dakota, who's number one in the world, I think, when it comes to aviation. I mean, our students go to the front of the line there if that's what they want to do. So it's just a huge need right now of pilots in the United States, so it's a good market.
Is that because just more and more people are flying, or is it because people are leaving that career because it's very difficult?
I think it's two things. I think it's, number one, there's just more flying that's going on. And I think number two, I'm going to say it again, I think it's an older workforce. The workforce is just older now. It's no different than even construction. Everything we hear, you know, people are retiring and they need young people to fill those positions. And so the same thing with aviation. They just need pilots to fill those positions because there's pilots that are older that would like to retire. In some cases, they're being kept on or asked to be stayed on because they just need them to fly. And so I think it's demand, really.
How would you compare and complement the style of learning that you can get at a career and technical academy versus at the traditional high school?
It's hands-on learning. It's about projects. I'm going to say it again. It's about projects. And so instead of, it's about collaboration. So our students are working together and figuring things out. Example would be auto tech. I mean, if you think about what a car looks like nowadays and how complicated the car is, I mean, somebody has to fix those cars. These are the students that are going to fix those cars. So learning about, you know, why do we have to learn this stuff? And by that I mean is, you know, these students still need English and math. I mean, you have to have that. But I think what we are able to do is we're going to say, this is why you need that math. In order to figure that out, this is why you're learning that. And so it really ties a nice connection between what they're learning on the academic world and what you're doing with the hands-on world.
When I was growing up, it seemed to me like there was just such a huge push for going on to a four-year and getting a liberal arts education, and that's what I have. And I think, you know, for my line of work, it is a good fit. But I feel like there was a push, and part of that was putting negative stereotyping on anyone who might pursue something like a shop class. And in movies, they were the kids who were smoking and ditching school. And I'm sitting here touring this academy. These kids know how to fly planes. They know how to attend to patients. They're doing graphic design. Were movies just lying to me? Or has there been a change that you have seen in how we are approaching post-high school education in this country?
There's been a change. I would say it's really in the last 15 years, especially in the last 5 years, you've seen a major, major change. You know, it used to be called vocational education, and I think it falls right back into what you said. And there was, if you didn't have to use your mind, as long as you use your hands. The new career and technical education is just about minds and hands, and so you need both. And I think the other thing that's happened is with industry is the need for quality workers, high demand workers, high skill wages. And so I think that's really done the push. What we like to think about of instead of being college and career ready, what about career and college ready? So depending on the career, it might be 1 year, it might be 2 year, it might be 3 year, it might be 4 year, it might be more than that. But instead of saying everybody's going to go to a 4 year university, we're saying whatever you want to do, that's fine. But then let's take you there and let's try to match that the amount of post-secondary education you want. And then the other thing I will tell you, there is an industry that I know of right now that if you have your two-year degree and you wanted to get a four-year degree, that they wouldn't help pay for that. So I think education's always going to be there. So instead of just saying, yep, we think that somebody with a four-year degree is smart, there's all kinds of smart. A carpenter is smart. Auto tech is smart. The new AI, artificial intelligence people are smart. And so it's just a different smart now. We're living in a world that we need all those people.
I've interviewed a lot of teachers, and a common theme that comes up is we are teaching students for careers that don't yet exist. How do you see that, and what is your approach for that within the Career Academy?
Well, and I think that's exactly right. Our approach is to be able to think on your own, be able to critically think, be able to diagnose. So no matter what comes up, you will be able to start critically thinking. If you're in that mindset of let's say, how a flow chart works, in other words, if something doesn't work, what's the next step? And you get in that kind of flow chart mentality, I think any job that comes up in the future, you could be ready for it. It's going to probably take some other training, but knowing what that training is and knowing how to collaborate with others, critical thinking, those are what everybody wants. And I think by having these classes, they're able to do that. We teach that here. We score students on those critical thinking skills.
What other changes have you seen within your time at the Bismarck Career Academy, and then perhaps if you were somewhere else before?
I think females coming into non-traditional places. You know, it used to be in the old days where if you were a female, you're going to go into nursing or you're going to be a teacher. That has really gone away, I will tell you that. And I think I give all the middle schools the credit. You know, with STEM education now in the middle school, you got girls, doing the same thing that boys are, and that's fantastic. So I would say that's the biggest thing right now that I see is the number of females that are getting into this. The other thing that really, really helps is having a nice building like the Career Academy. You know, so many times those are kind of dirty, dungy places that nobody wanted to go to, and, you know, especially females. And so it's something place that's nice and you feel welcome and it's, and you can do that. I think that really is one of the best things that we have to offer.
Are you seeing a change then in the industry down the line? And I'm going to do a broad overgeneralization about how I see women approach a problem and a solution and how men approach a problem and a solution. And I feel like it's fair to say that men and women often approach an issue very differently. So do you see a change in just the way that tends to be a more female way of thinking, and is that driving change within the industries?
I think some of the organization skills, I think some of the thought to detail, I think sometimes that we see in our female students compared to maybe some males that might, and I'm not saying that's all, I'm not trying to generalize at all, but I think you see that, and I think that has a tendency to rub off, and so I think, but I guess what we see is there isn't a job here, or there's not a class here where both the females can't excel in some cases in with the men, with the boys. I think the other thing, that's one of the biggest things I see nowadays too, you don't see where the guys or the boys would put down the girls. You don't see that. And I think in the old days maybe that sometimes you saw that where they would, you know, say, well, you're doing a man's thing. That doesn't happen with this generation of kids. And I think the other thing, they're more empathetic. They're more empathetic to students with special needs. And so I think I love these kids nowadays that they get a bad rap. Sometimes they think, well, these kids nowadays are lazy. I don't see that. I gotta tell you, I think they're empathetic. They allow everybody to, no matter what they are, to try something.
There's lots of lights, lots of windows. I feel very much like people should be paying to go here.
Yeah, and so that's just a new design of the classrooms, and I think we're fortunate enough that this building is 10 years old, and so we use what's called flexible furniture, you know, in many of the classes, and so students might be sitting in a room, and we have like a, I would say like a conference style. And so when it's time to get to work, you fold up the table, slide it out of the way, and then you start doing the projects on the floor. And so, you know, those are or in the room. And so flexible furniture, need for space, I guess, need for storage space. I mean, when we do projects, I mean, you can't put them in a file cabinet. You know, the projects have to go somewhere. And so the need for space, I think that's the other thing that in buildings like ours.
And you have about 1,300 students, and they're coming from around Bismarck, Mandan, and anywhere else?
Yeah, we have 1,300 students, and they come from the three high schools here in Bismarck. They come from the St. Mary's High School, which is a parochial school. They come from Shiloh, which is a Christian school, a homeschool, number of homeschool students that come here. And then we have a couple of students that come down from Wilton, which is about 20 miles away. And so it's truly a central location. And I think programs like this, you have to have that because they're expensive. And so you can't afford this in every single comprehensive high school.
Are you seeing more of these, or would you like to see more of these in the state of North Dakota?
Yeah, I think you have to see more of these. I think North Dakota right now, I think the governor last year recommended $30 million to build more career academies, and that's going to just come down the line. There's going to be more of that. There's a push now for this. It's okay now to build, and I say that, you know, before it was like we talked about before, well, you know, everything was about academics. Everything was about, AP. Well, they're starting to see that that's not the case anymore. And so to build more career academies, it has to look like this, where you're really integrating what you're learning on the academic world with hands-on learning.
And how do you learn from that approach to not go too far in the career and tech academy and then, you know, maybe overlooking the opposite?
And I think that's a good point. I think what you got to do, and, you know, some of our students would say the same way, well, why do I have to learn about music and all that? And I think, well, our message to students is because you need to be well-rounded. And well-rounded means, you know, being able to maybe fix your home, but well-rounded means knowing about what's happening in the political world. I think well-rounded means, you know, understanding and appreciation of music. And I think well-rounded means appreciation of literature. And so for our students to just say, well, all I want to do is be an auto tech. Yeah, we need auto techs. But on the same token, we want you to be able to have a family. We want you to be involved in the community. And so you might be leaders in your community, and that's going to take all kinds of learning.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Dale Haroth, Director of Career and Technical Education for Bismarck Public Schools, talking about the resurgence in hands-on learning experiences. Casey Wetzel is a senior hoping to become a private pilot. What drew you to the aviation program?
I kind of always had an interest in flying as I was younger. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I thought about military for a while, but now as I've taken this class, I've kind of changed to be more corporate as a civilian, like fly for a corporate company.
Is there flying in your family?
My grandfather was a pilot, a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. And he had 400 and something combat missions, and he actually flew the president. And that was actually something that really got me interested in aviation.
Is he still around? How does he feel about you being in this program?
He thinks it's really cool. I talk to him a lot about it because he's a pilot and I'm close with him, so it's pretty cool.
Has he talked at all about just the access to the education? Because I'm sitting here looking in this program, and this is some very high-end equipment.
Yeah, it's definitely a great opportunity, and any student can take it anywhere in the Bismarck Public School District, even some of the private schools like St. Mary's, Shiloh kids. We have kids in this program that are from those schools. So a lot of people have access to it, and it's a great program. I think we're definitely the only program in the state to own an airplane and actually fly, so it's really awesome.
What was it like that first time you actually got to go up in the plane?
It was definitely very nerve-wracking because I've never been in the cockpit of an airplane, and, you know. But being in this class, like the year one class is basically you learn all the basics, like ground school is what it's called, and you learn everything, how the airplane works, all the controls, everything, all the buttons. So you understand how it works, and when you go up there for your demo flight, usually you have a good understanding. So that helps a lot, but it's still nerve-wracking, and you get to fly during the demo flight. He lets you fly pretty much the whole time and land it if you're comfortable.
How does it compare with the experience of the flight simulations that you're using in the classroom?
Our more advanced one over there, it's based off of airplanes. Actually, all the buttons and everything that you see are actually interactive. They actually do something on the simulator, just like they would do in the airplane. We did have a virtual reality headset for a while. Kind of got that feeling of actually flying. It definitely helps a lot to have that. It helps, too, because all the physics are the same as flying, so you would feel how it actually would feel in an airplane. I mean, it's a little bit different, but...
Even, like, some of the, you know, just that gut, it can kind of change when you get that high in elevation, and then I assume there's a little bit of pressure when you're actually, like, manning the controls. Do you get the body experience of being in a plane while you're on the flight simulator?
It's a little bit different because you don't get to feel, like, the G-forces when you're turning and stuff, but, I mean, with the VR headset that we had, it was pretty close to accurate, but we're actually working on a simulator right now that's... We're going to have most of the controls inside of a cockpit, and we'll be able to use that. So it's like an airplane, but it's not a motion simulator, so it doesn't move. But there's definitely, I mean, it definitely helps.
Compare your experience here with your experience in the traditional high school classroom.
So this class, you get a lot more hands-on experience. You get a free demo flight in the airplane, so that means any student gets a free flight in the airplane with the instructor. Instead of a lot of homework and, like, the traditional, you know, taking notes in class, I mean, yeah, there's some of the notes and stuff, but you get to learn on the simulators, all that stuff. I mean, the drone program, you get to fly drones in here. You get to do a lot of stuff that's different, and it's a lot more fun. I mean, it's not like school where you have pressure, you have homework and all that stuff. It's just, it's all hands-on and learning.
Almost like you forget you're learning.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's like having a career almost. It's basically being in the career field. So,
you said that you want to go on and possibly fly in the corporate world. Does that mean commercial airlines or does that mean private?
So corporate is like flying for like a smaller company. So you'd be flying around like some of their business or like businessmen or something like that. It's not commercial where you're flying around passengers. I mean, you are flying around passengers, but it's usually smaller jets or smaller airplanes that are fast and get you, but it's different.
Do you have a favorite plane?
Yeah, it's called a TBM-850. It's a single-engine turbine. It's really fast, and it's really nice. I mean, some of the newer ones, they have really nice instruments. They're all glass, computer screens, basically, for the instruments. And it's got autopilot. It's really nice. It's expensive, but it's more affordable than jets.
What do you mean when you say expensive? Give me a number.
$1 million, probably. Yeah. So it's expensive, but I mean, for a nice airplane that's fast, it'll get you around. That's probably around the price range you're looking at.
Do you get into the business and the economic side of what it means to be a private pilot or a corporate pilot? Like $1 million, I don't have to buy $1 million of equipment in order to do my career. Yeah. So do you study that end of it?
Yeah, we learn about what it's like to work for people. I mean, sometimes when you get jobs, like especially like for like flying boxes, like cargo, it's timed. There's a lot of pressure from your bosses and stuff. So you have to keep in mind, like, the government regulations versus what your boss actually says. And, like, for the business, I mean, you have to separate those two things, maintain safety while you're flying. So we learn a lot about that so that we are safe when we fly.
Do corporate pilots and private pilots typically have to own their own plane in order to make it work?
Usually not. They usually supply the airplane. They buy it. You're just the one flying it, basically.
Do you get nervous?
It depends. I mean, not really. I'm used to it now. I mean, I always have that, like, you know, you always have to be prepared if something does go wrong. So you don't become complacent, but I'm not nervous. I'm confident in myself.
Weather-wise, North Dakota seems like it would, let's put this nicely, be a good training ground for extreme weather conditions.
Yes, definitely. As a pilot, you have to be prepared for all sorts of weather. You look at forecasts and everything, wind, precipitation, all that good stuff. Make sure you're safe, and that's a big reason that problems happen. Yeah, definitely. North Dakota has some crazy winds. I mean, 50-mile-an-hour winds in a small airplane, that's dangerous.
So what have you learned about when and how to make the call of, is this something, you know, obviously you're not flying professionally yet, but I assume you have started to study when you would say, Not today, folks.
Yeah, there's rules and regulations that the government provides that say what weather you can fly in, visibilities and stuff like that. And also the airplane, it's rated up to a certain wind speed of like crosswind and stuff like that where you can fly in, that it's safe. Beyond that, I mean, it's kind of your call if you're comfortable flying it. Like if it's legal, you can fly in it, but it's your call if you feel comfortable flying in that.
That was Casey Wetzel, a senior in high school who's taking aviation courses at the Bismarck Career Academy and Tech Center. Still to come on Main Street, we have an essay from Mark Trahant, and we visit with Laurel Reuter of the North Dakota Museum of Art. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Bismarck's University of Mary has decided to temporarily close its Rome campus and bring the students back to the United States. Dr. David Tamesia is the dean of UMary School of Arts and Sciences. He says the university has been keeping tabs on the situation with COVID-19, the new coronavirus. The Centers for Disease Control has now issued a level 3 travel warning for Italy and a do not travel advisory for some areas of northern Italy.
Once it became clear to us that there may be a risk to our students, the possibility of being exposed to the virus but also not being able to return home, because of some of the travel restrictions, we made a decision that it would be best to close the program and give our students an opportunity to return home.
Tamesia says the students will return to their homes to stay with family for a period of 2 weeks so they can be screened for the virus. But he says the university wants to make a difficult situation to something positive, so the students will have a chance to spend the last 5 weeks of the semester at its Arizona campus, which is right next to Arizona State University.
It's a beautiful campus. We have a beautiful library, we have classroom space, we have some of our current students from the main campus down there right now, and there are all kinds of opportunities that we have there. We have hikes planned in the Grand Canyon, in Sedona, there's cultural activities and social activities in the Phoenix area, so we're really trying to turn it into something positive for our Rome students.
There are 25 students at the Rome campus. At the start of the year, officials with the Roman Catholic Church released the names of known priests accused of sexually abusing children. The list from the Fargo Diocese and Bismarck Diocese contained 54 names of priests. Since that disclosure, attorneys with the Fargo law firm O'Keefe, O'Brien, Lyson, and Foss have been requesting additional information from the church. Here's attorney Mark Bryant.
What they didn't do when they released that list was they didn't release the assignment list. And what the assignment list is where all of these priests were. And where almost every other diocese, when they release a list, puts that list out, they've chosen not to do that. We sent them a letter telling them to do that, that they should do that, because it's real easy for them. It's in the front of every file. So it's something they easily could have copied and put out. They still chose not to do that.
Bryant says area parishes were notified by the Archdiocese before the list came out. They were informed of priests that had been in their parish. The parishes were then told to reach out to their members to make sure they are safe. Bryant says developing the list of a priest's history takes some time to develop, but it's necessary.
There's two things. One, we want to see what's happened in the past, but we also, for all the priests that are still alive that are on these lists, we want to know where there are now because they're still potentially dangerous to children.
Bryant says it's believed there are more names. He says he would like to see North Dakota lawmakers extend the statute of limitation laws to allow more victims to step forward. Bryant says Attorney General Wayne Stengem has stated he would work with lawmakers and encourage the move. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Disasters like floods tend to hit the most vulnerable people the hardest. And that can be true in the world of diseases and infections, too. Around the world, the coronavirus, or COVID-19, is impacting developing nations harder than it is impacting the first world. In this week's Trahant Reports, Mark Trahant, editor of Indian Country Today, shares how this could impact native life.
In her book, Pox Americana, Elizabeth Fenn writes about how fast smallpox spread across the continent. Fenn looked at Spanish burial records to trace the spread from Mexico City to missions in New Mexico. She found out how the disease made its way via trade routes from the fur country of Hudson Bay to the Pacific coast. The disease raced ahead of Lewis and Clark, so much so that when the captains made their way across the Bitterroot Mountains, they were witnessing the tribes that had already been deeply impacted by the epidemic. One phrase that struck with me came from an Assiniboine scholar who wrote, "Entire bands died." And so it was about 100 years ago when a violent strain of the flu went global. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that 500 million people, more than a quarter of the world's population, were infected with that virus. And some 50 million worldwide died, with about 675,000 deaths in the United States. As my colleague Jacqueline Estes wrote in Indian Country Today, the village of Brevik Mission in northwestern Alaska lost nearly every resident. 72 of the 80 Inupiaq people died within 5 days. The village of Wales buried 172 people. Influenza devastated people in their 20s and 30s, productive hunters and food gatherers. Some survivors in isolated villages ended up starving to death in the aftermath. And this new virus, COVID-19, already has significant implications globally. The effect on the world economy is alarming, and regions of the planet from China to Iran are in shutdown mode, as people are staying home, trying to limit the spread. Many cases have been relatively mild, and some of those infected are believed to show no symptoms at all. But that is the ideal way for an infectious disease to spread. On Facebook, there is renewed interest, at least from my friends, in ending the practice of shaking hands. That is an old tradition. One of the earlier references is found in the 9th century, which shows an Assyrian leader sealing an alliance. Pairs of clasped hands even appeared on Roman coins. And Lewis and Clark handed out dozens of peace and friendship coins as they journeyed across the West. But when you shake hands, you pick up germs. So as this virus spreads, perhaps the handshake is a tradition that is coming to an end. I'm Mark Trahant.
Trahant Reports is produced at the studio of Indian Country Today. Coming up next, one man's treasure is one museum's exhibit.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. Human beings are joke tellers. We take great satisfaction making people laugh and have warm feelings for those who think we are funny. But what makes a joke work, and why can only some people tell them? Are there subjects we shouldn't joke about? And is it true that humor is dangerous? Join me and my guest Al Jeaney as we ask these questions and hopefully laugh a bit while we do.
That's this Sunday at 5 Central, 4 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me from our microphone in Grand Forks is Laurel Reuter. She is the founding director and chief curator at the North Dakota Museum of Art. Laurel, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Happy to be here.
We're going to talk about some events that are coming up and also some things that are currently on display. Frankly, I have to start with this one called Barton's Place.
Oh, sure.
What is this?
This is a permanent installation of Barton's apartment in New York City. Barton died a few years ago, and he was a wonderful collector, lots of African, lots of inane, lots of all kinds of things. And we had gone out to dinner one night, and he said, "What am I going to do with all this stuff?" I said, "Oh, give it to me. I'll make a 21st century artist period room." Well, then he did.
And when we say stuff, I mean, I'm looking at this photo and I'm seeing giant giraffes. I'm seeing rugs. There's memorabilia everywhere. This is like walking into an eccentric's mind.
Exactly. And he chose for what things look like, but he has embedded in it a marvelous collection of African art. Mm. And that resulted in the museum receiving an additional two collections of African art.
Wow.
So,
and
were lots of spin-offs.
And you were absolutely serious when you said, "Hey, just give it to me."
Well, I was serious, but I never thought about the consequences. But I did think it was a way of introducing a lot of African stuff to our state.
How is it that you came to meet Barton?
Oh, we met each other years before through the architect who renovated our building. And he kept saying, "You two got to meet." And we met, and I thought, another gay guy. And he thought, middle-class woman. And then we became the best of friends. And we always had fun.
Yeah. What was the process like of actually getting all of these things from his apartment in New York City to now their new permanent home in Grand Forks?
Well, I sent a photographer in about three times to his apartment to really record what it was there and what it looked like. Mm-hmm. And then after he died, we sent maybe three staff members, went to New York, and they hired two big trucks, 24-foot trucks, and they packed and they crated it all up and they brought it back to North Dakota. And then we built a facsimile of the apartment wow. on the top floor of the museum and just began installing using the pictures.
When you said that you hadn't maybe quite considered all the consequences of this decision, so walk me through, you've just received these truckloads of memorabilia. Was there a moment, a specific object where you said, oh boy?
Actually, no.
Really?
I like solving visual problems like that, and so it was great fun. And it was fun because the whole staff participated, as is common, and we just had a good time.
I love that you said that phrase, solving visual problems, because all of the sudden, art museums make so much more sense to me than they have. And I struggle with art museums because I'm the kind of person who likes to touch things and to smell things and to really get right up in my face with what I'm trying to learn about. And that's typically frowned upon at an art museum.
I totally agree with you. I'm the same. And for instance, when we have a big quilt show, the mothers are always telling the kids, don't run, don't do this, don't do that. But they, and then in their own lives, cannot see what a textile is without touching it. And so it's always an issue.
Yeah. So how do you keep that in mind when you are setting up exhibitions at the North Dakota Museum of Art? And maybe we'll pick on a current exhibition. Walk us through consequences. What is this?
Consequences is a very interesting exhibition by a printmaker who also makes objects. And her name is Lynn Allen, and she'll be here next week. And within consequences are endangered species, Native American culture, all of the things that we are doing that are having long-term consequences. For instance, among the endangered species is a human, because we are also endangering human life. So those are the consequences. The show has lots of prints. And then Alan began making objects out of paper that echo moccasins, beautiful bags. And then that became her work in response to her great-great-grandmother's having written the history of the Lakota Sioux. And so this thing it's a collaboration over many generations.
Yeah, and Alan is descended from the Hunkpapa band, like you mentioned, of the Lakota people. And this was very much an instance of, yes, that was the descendants, that was the ancestry, but she was raised culturally white. What do you know about her exploration of her own ancestry? And how is that reflected in the show?
I had dinner with her a couple weeks ago in Chicago. And she's just as white-looking as she can be. Mm. But she discovered her great-grandmother's journals. And after she began, once she discovered them, she began making objects such as purses, arrow slings, moccasins, crafted from paper, and then stitched and lacquered and painted and all of that. Mm. And so through her great-grandmother's writings and her objects, she began to discover her relationship to her past through her mother. And she's done remarkable work, both in her own work and in rescuing her great-great-grandmother's history. Mm-hmm. And she got the University of Nebraska Press to print the book, and she is a woman who has reached out in lots of different directions.
That show is called Consequences. It's on display at the North Dakota Museum of Art through April 5th, and the artist, Lynn Allen, will be at UND at the museum speaking on March 11th at 6 p.m. You also are having John Bruce Yeh, who is known in the music world, of course, as a clarinetist for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, but around these parts, he's a lot more likely to be known as Molly Yeh's dad.
Exactly. And that's really what prompted me to want to do this. I thought, she comes from such an important music background, and people will be interested. So we contacted him, and he was quite interested, but he wanted to come when she was being filmed for her Food Network show.
Yeah, her show is called Girl Meets Farm.
Right. And so at the concert this coming Sunday, the film crew will also be there. And they promised not to get in the way of the concert or interrupt in any way, but they'll have their cameras set up.
Wow.
So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, and just the fact that he is the longest tenured clarinetist in the history of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, how long are we talking here?
Probably 30 years.
Wow.
That long
family,
time.
So talented.
Exactly.
Tell me about the event you have coming up also on the 11th, so same day as the Lynn Allen talk, but at 4 o'clock there is going to be a lecture with David Troyer. He is the author of the book The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, which was selected as a finalist for the National Book Award and for the Carnegie Medal. We've had him on our show a number of times. He's going to be coming and talking.
Yeah, and he's going to discuss the election and recent American history, and will also discuss how, in order to understand modern America, we need to know Native American history. I'm reading that because he just sent me that note. What's very important about him is he's from Leech Lake Reservation, teaches at University of California, Berkeley, no, Southern California, is that he has a very optimistic point of view about what's happened with Native American people since Wounded Knee. They didn't go away as a bunch of drunks, no good, couldn't do anything. They became a powerful contemporary force within our larger culture. And because he's going to talk about that, we put up a second exhibition called Celebrations. And this is work from our collection that deals with joy, with abstraction, with happiness. And it just seemed like such a good marriage of a very optimistic point of view. Where Consequences, in the opposite gallery, is you better watch out.
Yeah. You're really going full Gemini on these exhibitions.
That's right. You know, we've in the last year started building our exhibitions out of our permanent collection because we have such a terrific collection.
Mm.
And then we add other artists. We bring others in and speakers and all kinds of other things. But
How far in advance are you working on current exhibitions? Are we talking a year, 5 years?
Some of them stay in my mind for 5 years. Mm. Some of them I'll do next month.
Mm.
There are two big ones that I'm working on. And the Warhol Foundation has funded my research on both projects. And one is on drones. It'll be a large exhibition. Probably will open when the deep winter sets in November, because a lot of the work will be outside. And it's the power of drones in the hands of artists, where they transform it into something else. And then the other exhibition is called Children of Chaos. And many years ago, I did an exhibition called The Disappeared, and that was in Latin America. And that was at that point the Warhol called and said, we've never had our money go so far. What do you want to do next? I didn't have a clue. I was just finished with this huge project. And so I just blurted out, well, I want to know what it means to be a woman in the Middle East. And they sent me $50,000 for research. And I was really, I didn't know what to do because all of a sudden everybody was doing an exhibition about veils. Mm. And I didn't think that veils was what it was about. It wasn't the role of clothes. And I've long been interested in the effects of war and how artists treat it. And then I decided, you know, children are the one who suffer. Mm. They're the ones. And it's not just war, but in all of life circumstances, it's the little ones who are damaged or who have to cope. And so that exhibition I've been gradually working on for quite a long time.
Wow. Do you have a sense of when that will open?
It certainly will open within the next year.
Okay.
I'm getting so old, I have to do things fast.
Where does most of the funding for the North Dakota Museum of Art come from?
Oh, I dig and look and search and beg, and we have to raise almost all of it. The only state money we get is for our Rural Arts Initiative, whereby we send exhibitions out all over North Dakota to any venue that has heat and is secure. And so, for instance, out of the current consequences show, we're going to do a show endangered species probably. And we just did we've had several calls what's coming next from various places, and four people booked for their communities that exhibition already, and I'm still putting it together.
Oh, wow. Are you collaborating then with, for example, the North Dakota Council on the Arts when you're doing these touring shows, or who takes the lead on this kind of thing?
We do. Okay. The museum does. But we collaborate with all kinds of communities, rural arts communities all over the place. Probably 30 different communities take our rural exhibitions.
Wow.
And I always insist it be real art. I'm not going to just send out posters. And it's been perfectly secure.
How do you keep your permanent collection safe? Like, how do you store a permanent collection?
You try to get a hold of the building next door to you and turn it into collection storage. Okay. That's our current plan. The big armory, if we can fund it. Okay.
But I would imagine there's light, there's temperature, there's humidity.
All of that, yep. Okay. Currently, we have a space within the museum on the ground floor, the bottom floor, and we rent one larger space off campus, and we have two others off campus that we also use. So for us, it's our biggest challenge right now.
I would think, yeah. We're visiting with Laurel Reuter. She is the founding director and chief curator at the North Dakota Museum of Art. They have a lot of cool exhibits on display right now and a number of events coming up in the next few weeks. Laurel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra presents an evening of fun and games Saturday, March 7th at 7:30 p.m. in the Ann Nicole Nelson Hall on the MSU campus. This Pops concert program features iconic themes from some well-known games, including selections from Lara Croft Overture, Civilization IV, and Assassin's Creed. You're invited to dress as your favorite game character. Also winner of the MSU Honor Concerto competition, Sean Bostrom will perform Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue with the symphony. Tickets available now at MinotSymphony.com or by phone at 701-858-4228.
Frances Mays loves eating out in Italy.
There's such a high standard of appreciation of food.
Consider San Miguel de Allende in Mexico.
It's a pretty easy place to retire. It's a pretty easy place to go if you don't speak Spanish well.
And hear why many Scots are unhappy with being in the UK.
Independence was a dream, and I was part of that dream.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 3rd. In 1891, the New Ulm Weekly reported that wolves had become troublesome. Sheep owners were especially concerned. On this date in 1899, the Oaks Republican reported the sighting of a gray wolf north of the Great Northern Railway line. A party of men, out with their dogs, spotted the wolf and took up the chase, which kept up until the wolf reached the river. The dogs lost time in the crossing, but the wolf didn't. At that point, the men cut their losses, admitting that the wolf had outsmarted them. At one time, wolves were common in North Dakota. The gray wolf was also known as the plains wolf and the buffalo wolf. They had ranged across the entire North American continent with numbers estimated at 2 million. Humans nearly exterminated them with trapping, shooting, and poisoning subsidized by the government. In 1907, the North Dakota legislature paid $2 per wolf. As late as 1923, South Dakota's wolf bounty was higher than North Dakota's, so some hunters took their North Dakota wolves to South Dakota to claim the higher bounty. Other hunters killed the youngest and oldest ones, but left the breeding wolves. That way, hunters were assured that there would continue to be a wolf population to keep the bounties coming. By the 1960s, there were only a few gray wolves left in northern Minnesota and in Isle Royale National Park in Michigan. After becoming federally protected under the Endangered Species Act, gray wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone National Park in 1995. While it remains controversial, the wolves have improved the environment by keeping elk herds on the move so they don't overgraze areas. This has led to an increased beaver population, which in turn has improved rivers and streams. Although the wolves are generally gray, the coloring can range from pure white to completely black. Wolf packs generally claim a home range of 30 to 50 square miles. They hunt deer, elk, and small animals like beaver. A wolf pack can even take down an adult bison. Today, gray wolves are known as an incidental species in North Dakota. There are occasional sightings, but no known breeding population. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
You can purchase a book of Dakota Datebooks at shopprairiepublic.org.
The coronavirus is spreading, and scientists are using computers to try to predict what will happen next.
I would say that I've never seen the modeling community so galvanized, you know, around this outbreak and willing to share and collaborate.
But can a mostly voluntary effort keep up with a growing crisis?
Having a more formal relationship could really improve that data sharing, which in turn would improve the quality of the models.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, well, they have that expression, you are what you eat. Sometimes what we eat doesn't really like us that much. Meg Pennington is an expert on food sensitivity, and she joins us to talk about what foods can trigger certain reactions, such as chronic inflammation, fatigue, and digestive issues. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.